If Murray has supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
The Blubbity Blah.
Sending out good vibes.
Good vibes. Underneath breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Grimerica Show. Coming at you this week with a special one, the Prince of Pot, Mark Emery. We had him on our Outlawed show, and it went so well, we just had to do this one, release it here as well. So if you are an Outlawed person, this is the same episode that just came out Friday. The first hour only, not the extra half hour that we did over there, but...
Or Saturday? Is it coming out Friday or Saturday?
Saturday. Yeah. So the first hour. It is the same show if you're to listen to that, so you might want to skip it. Of course, we are on the road again with Randall Carlson and Brad Young and the rest of the gang down in the Columbia Gorge. When this comes out, we'll be somewhere around Lewiston, Idaho, or Clarkston, Washington, following the trail of famous Lewis and Clark. Of course, that trip is packed up and we're already there, so you can't come to that. But if you do... if you're like, man, I got to go on one of these trips, head over to contact@thecabin.com. We do still have the trip coming up in November to Invermere here in Canada. If you're in the States, it's a cheap trip. Cheap trip. Our dollar is way down right now. So once you get here, everything will be cheap. And, well, relatively. I mean, everything's a fortune. So you might not notice as much of a difference as you used to. But it's worth the trip. It's going to be a blast. We'll be on the top of the mountain. And in that respect, it will be a shorter episode, since we're pre-recording just a bunch of content so that you guys don't skip a beat. I mean, this is the things we do to make sure that our listeners never know when we've got other stuff going on. The show just keeps going on, keeps going. And of course, I'll be married by the time this comes out. It's like the day, 2 days before the wedding. It's September 11th. A lot going on. We got a bunch of people we've met through the show that a few of them, Dan and Dan will be here right away. Oliver, Laura, Casey, Nikki, the dude, Mike, the liberal. Oh, Chuck, all coming through for the wedding. Getting here in the next day or two. So going to be a hell of a time. Of course, Graham's officiating. So Pastor Graham.
I hope that's all I have to do. I'm not really prepared to do much else. I hope that, you know, that's it. Just say the things.
Well, and then you also have to sign the
put the rings on the fingers and, you know, like get her done. Yeah.
And then you'll have to sign the thing as well.
Okay, course. Yeah, that's no problem.
All easy peasy, nothing to it. Yeah. Easy stuff. So, of course, support. If you want to support us, head over to grimerica.ca/support. You want to send some wedding money or just some general money, whatever, some value for value. If you're getting some value from the show, grimerica.ca/support. Of course, we do try and use these little whatever we can to try and get people to come out of the slouch and donate. We tried Graham's birthday, it didn't. We tried my birthday before, it didn't work out. I mean, we were pumping the wedding though, and a few people did come through. I don't know.
Our
general whining for support or because of the special occasion, but
they would be considered nobles now, right? So
absolutely,
this is a special marriage in Grimerica. But I mean, they are donating as nobles now. A few people have reached like Lord and Lady, which is what, $1,000 overall of,
yeah, we got four Lords, no ladies.
Four Lords, no ladies.
Yeah.
And the rest of you are serfs out there just watching,
yeah, listening. Sir. Yeah. When the shit goes down, you won't be allowed inside the walls. You won't get protection. So serfs a couple bucks. And then
so the nobles get the drawbridge comes down for the nobles and they get let in when the collapse happens.
Like, yeah, that's right. America.ca/support. Sign up today. And of course, we'll read your note if you send us some money too, so you can get it out there to a bunch of people, you know, 40, 50,000 people, maybe more. It's hard to track. We don't really know, but that's what it was before they started fucking around with everything and didn't really tell us anymore. But we do have some people to thank. We got The weird double number theory where we got 33, 33 one-time donation from two people on Stripe within like an hour of each other. The first one was Genevieve Jones.
And like, just for context, like, when was the last time we got a 33, 33 one-time donation?
On Stripe? Maybe never.
So isn't that weird?
Yeah. And then we got another one, which you have a note from Matthew Adams, 33, 33.
Hi, fellas. I sent you a small 33, 33 donation to show my appreciation and love for the show. Graymerica has been such a blessing to me, and I know it will come back to you both in big ways. Please keep it up and don't get discouraged during these challenging times. I also want to congratulate Darren on his upcoming wedding. All the best to you, buddy. He's also got a little, I might as well read this. This is his theory he wants to run by Randall about the Azores and Atlantis. Lastly, I want to mention a theory that I had that I hope you can run by Randall next time you see him. This is based on his theory of Atlantis being the sunken Azores plateau and the thought that it may have sunk due to the melting of the ice sheet and the weight transfer from land to the ocean. Like a teeter-totter, when the ice was on land, it depressed the land and raised the Azores at the mid-Atlantic ridge. My theory is that there is something very special sunken there, like something possibly connected to the earth grid that powered the pyramids. And when it sunk, all the old tech no longer worked. This could be the reason for the elites trying to cool the planet again, and in my mind, bring on another ice age to raise to Azores again and bring back that lost technology. It sure seems like all the climate change hysteria, like spraying particles in the air and reducing CO2, will inevitably bring on an ice age, and it is almost seems intentional. Anyway, might be crazy thought, but just thought I'd throw it out there. Thanks again, guys.
That's right. Or it could be to keep us low on carbon or on CO2 so we don't turn into giants again. Right. We do have a couple more people to thank. Of course, we have Ray Howard. Sent us $100. Or is that the note you just read? No.
Nope. This is Ray Howard.
$100. Now, Ray, if you're listening, you signed up for a monthly. So did you mean to sign up for $100? I mean, that's a 10-month plan to a Lord. To be a Lord in a year. But if you didn't mean to, let us know or cancel it. So,
and he says, hello, gentlemen. Love both the podcasts. Listen every week. Wanted to gift Darren this hundo for his wedding. Congratulations, man.
Thank you, sir. And then you didn't get a note from Josh Young?
No.
But he also sent $100.
So,
and he just said, cheers, boys. So
nice.
Thanks, Josh. It's always nice when we complain and people step up. So thanks. You guys are really pulling the slack. You guys and all the other people on monthlies, all our other nobles, are really pulling the slack and keeping the show going. When it does get tough and discouraging, you really help us keep going and keep doing our best out here. So thank you. Thank you. I mean, if we could do this every week, we could, you know, that'd be like a huge raise for us. If we just got like, I mean, it doesn't even sound like a lot of money. We're at $250 this week. If we did that every week, that'd be a raise for us. An actual, we could actually pay each other, pay ourselves an extra $500 a month each. So come on, guys. You can do it. Sign up today. Check out our other podcast too, GrimericaOutlaw.ca. Hey, you could go check out if you love this chat, this is a rare thing where I could tell you to go over there and you could get an extension to it. There's some great stories for sure. And what else? Adultbrain.ca. We got a bunch of great audiobooks out there. We just had the religious one that's going to come out right away. Religious Experiences, isn't it?
Is that coming out?
I got it submitted, so yeah.
Oh, wow, man. Yeah, I mean, that's the classic William James, The Varieties of Religious Experiences. I mean, The Varieties of Religious Experience. It's not experiences. It's, yeah. I was recommended to read that book when I got into recovery like 15 years ago by my sponsor. So it's just a pleasure to be able to narrate that for everybody. I think it's going to be a good one.
Yeah. And the Machiavelli one came out already. The Machiavelli one's on Audible already.
The Prince by Machiavelli. Yeah, that was interesting too.
I thought there might be one more.
Man, he was like, he was an advocate of arming the population. It was crazy back then. What was it? The 1400s, that one? 1500s? Yeah, and it was a letter to a new noble, new king or prince. And man, because he'd been studying all this, and it just, I don't know, man, it was pretty mind-blowing too, how much they knew back then, you know, in the 1400s. how much they studied the political stuff and freedom and arming the population and like how they had to be, they had to walk that fine line about being nice to the peasants, you know, like this was a thing. Like it made me realize that I bet you a lot of those monarchies weren't that bad back then. Cause they had to be, they had to keep the people. I feel like nowadays they don't have to give, they don't give a shit about keeping us happy.
They don't care. And then of course we have also new out of The Social Contract, the works of Edgar Allan Poe, volume 5, Tales of Mystery and
Occultism.
And Utopia finally makes it out on audio, on Audible. So all great stuff to check out.
That's Thomas More's classic.
That's right. That's right. I think you got anything else?
That's about it.
That's about it. We're traveling. We'll be back next week. We'll let you know how the trip went and get you up to speed on everything else. And we'll make up for this short one. Please support us. Grimeamerica.ca/support if you're getting some value from the show. But most of all, enjoy this chat with the Prince of Pop, Mark Emery.
We've got Mark Emery with us, the Prince of Pot. This will be a good, a special episode for me because I grew up in Vancouver. Actually, Vancouver kind of took me down. So now I'm living in a small town in the middle of Saskatchewan and Darren's in Alberta. So welcome to Grimerica, Mark. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I mean, we've got so much to talk about. It's really weird, like listening to you chat for a bit and learning a little bit about what you're like in 2024, like how many things we have in common. Because of course I remember you from your Prince of Pot days, being a youngster in Vancouver, illegally smoking weed everywhere, you know? So I guess we got to touch on your past and why they're calling you the Prince of Pot. I mean, if you don't mind, you probably told the story a million times, but I think it's worth it for our listeners so we know who we've got with us here tonight.
Well, the Prince of Pot actually was given to me by the Seattle Post-Intelligencer back when they were still a newspaper. Back in 1996, and they just made it up, right? Because newspapers used to like that alliterative thing, right? The Pope of Dope, Prince of Pot. Things that rhymed or things that were alliterative were very appealing to newspapers. They used to try and do it all the time, make clever puns or clever remarks on newspaper headlines. Well, they just said, Canada's Prince of Pot has issues. Now, it's a very strange thing. So when CNN contacts me a few months later, and this is during one of my various ascendancies, right? Like what happened is I would become really famous and then I'd get raided, busted, put in jail, and then released, and it would be on the low again, and then I'd have to build back up, become more famous, and then get busted again. And so it's cyclical in nature, my fame and notoriety. But what happened is the Wall Street Journal called me the Prince of Pot moments after CNN did, and they went to it was a certain segment, a black fellow used to run it, Impact. Yes, it was called Impact, CNN's Impact. And this one was visiting me. And it was a whole half-hour episode on CNN coming to my cannabis culture, which was called BC Marijuana Party headquarters at the time, or Hemp BC for that matter, back in those days. And so they did this great show, put me on CNN, which made me enormously famous. And and then I got raided a second time after that. Whenever I was in big American media, I always got raided shortly after, but never after big Canadian media. I could have been on CBC every day smoking weed, saying I'm selling weed, nothing would happen. But as whenever I was in Rolling Stone, I got rated. When I was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, I got rated. When I was on CNN, I got rated. I mean, we're talking big time. And the people at Wall Street Journal even warned me. They said, Mark, the president reads Wall Street Journal. So are you really prepared to be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal saying your job is to overthrow the, you know, cannabis criminalization in the United States? I was very specific, and it was just, you know, my in-between goal. My real goal was to legalize cannabis in the United States. And to that end, I actually used so much of my profits. I gave away $5 million in that 10 years from 1995 to 2005. I'd probably gone beyond the statute of limitations. So I can tell you that I used to use a huge amount of that money to pay for ballot initiatives in the United States. For example, I first learned I could do this in 1998 when Washington, D.C. wanted to put legalization of marijuana on the ballot. And a group of people said, well, we need lots of money to do that, because to get signatures, you have to pay about $1 a signature. And we're going to need about 70,000 signatures. So that's minimum $70,000. And I thought, really? And we could get it on the ballot for like 70,000 bucks. And they said, yeah. So I said, oh, I'll contribute to that. So that year I gave 20,000 bucks. It got on the ballot and it actually passed. And I thought, that's amazing. And then unfortunately, Congress, through what you'll check up as the Barr Amendment, blocked it, because they can block expenditures in Washington, D.C. out of the Congress, which they can't do anywhere else. So then I thought, oh, bummer. Okay, so the next thing that came to me was in the year 2000, people in Colorado said, Mark, I think we could do a medical marijuana initiative here. I said, how many signatures do we need? It was something like 85,000. Okay, now this one I paid for almost all of it, right? I gave them 50,000 US to go get those signatures, and we got 30,000 from somebody else. And then they got the signatures, and it passed in 2008. I thought, this is, or 2000. I said, this is amazing. I can have this huge outcome on the U.S. political scene, right? With money that Americans are sending me for these seeds, right? So I got intoxicated by that. I contributed huge amounts to the Arizona initiative, which passed in both 2000, but it was overturned by courts. Then again in 2002, and then it passed. And then Alaska was 2000, 2002, 2004, didn't pass in those years, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I was amazed that I was, but you know what? I also used to advertise and tell people I was doing this. I would say, your money when spent with me will go to these things, right? So that's why I did so much business. People liked the, you know, subversive nature of what I was doing with the money, but they also needed the great seeds to grow great weed. So it was win-win for 10 years. And then, boy, imagine my surprise on July 29, 2005. When I got arrested, not that big a surprise, but when I read the warrant and it said wanted for extradition to the United States, and I thought, fuck, I'd never thought of that, right? Despite all my subversion, I thought I would just get charged in Canada for shit and put in our jails here. But this thing said wanted for extradition to the United States for a massive amount of bad sounding crimes related to trafficking. And they were asking for 28 to 40 years. So that began a different journey. So, you know, up and down.
So you're really advocating way back in the 90s for legalization of weed. I mean, you were the one sort of, I mean, you were, you know, pretty popular all through Canada. You know, you were the one that
it starts out as legalizing books, because all books and magazines about cannabis were banned.
Right.
In 1985, the Mulroney government just banned everything. And I thought, I was a bookseller. I thought, really? Like, that can happen in a free society? You can just ban books like that? Like, I couldn't believe it. And it wasn't like the parliament specifically said that. The law just said no printed matter about any illicit drug is to be permitted. Well, that's like everything, right? So High Times was banned in 1985. Grow Your Own Stone, the only Canadian book about growing, was Grow Your Own Stone, and it was banned. The publisher, Rainbow Books, got raided and had 5,000 copies seized. And there was no uproar. Like, government's just coming and seizing a whole warehouse full of books they don't like. It was bizarre. So I said, oh, come on, right? But it took me kind of like a few years to get my mojo up to take it on. So in 1990, I started advertising that I was going to import shitloads of books about marijuana and all drugs, every drug, you name it, LSD. I was going to get back issues of High Times, whatever I could find about drugs, smuggle them in, because they had to be smuggled. And I smuggled them all in, and then I bought a big ad in the newspaper saying, I was going to break this law. I dare you to come and charge me. And so, but what happens is, though, the police go, we're not going to fall into his trap, right? Meaning, okay, I can announce I'm breaking the law, but you're not going to charge me. That's fascinating. So I got to sell jillions, thousands and thousands of books to Canadians about illicit drugs, and I didn't get charged until an undercover officer in a high school in Toronto in 94, went into high school and started asking for weed, and 50 kids volunteered to get it for her. And then summarily, she charged them all 50 of them with trafficking, right? Now, this was outrageous. It was also entrapment, because entrapment is when you can get someone who wouldn't normally do it to do a crime because the inducement is so great. Like, in other words, if you're a criminal and you break into things for a living, you can't be entrapped. You're already prone to criminality. But if you're a total Joe Schmo and he's down in his luck and needs $20,000 and some cop comes up and said, I'll give you $50,000 if you do this and this, that's entrapment, because you wouldn't normally do that. Okay, so basically what happened is she basically tried to entrap every high school kid is going to do whatever a pretty woman wants if they pay any attention to you. So I thought this was scandalous. So we print up a pamphlet. And it was just an innocuous pamphlet called 10 Things About Marijuana That Every Parent, Teacher, and Student Should Know. And it's the most basic, unbiased, you know, like, easy, like really not, what would you call it? Not ideological, that we gave out in front of the high school where all these kids were charged. And that's how we got charged. And that's how we struck down that law. It wasn't anything to do with all the things they were trying to get. A police officer just stupid enough to give us a summons to come to court for giving out illegal cannabis literature. But it was political, so it's the most protected kind. So the judge immediately said, no, you can't have laws like that. That law's out of there. Right? It's the only time in Canada I've ever seen someone do the mille. Afuero! It's out. Wow. Get out of there. Right? And it was struck down. And it was never appealed, so technically it's still only binding in Ontario. But no one's ever been charged since. And the same thing happened with my Two Live Crew when I went to court in 1990 for the Two Live Crew, because the Ontario Provincial Police had gone to every store and said, if you sell it, we'll charge you. And I said, since when do the cops get to determine what's valid music? Never. So I got 100 copies of that from Detroit, had my friend go and get it, bring them to me. And then we advertised we were going to sell this CD and we were going to break the law. Now, in that case, an undercover cop was the second guy in line. He bought a copy. He went back. He listened to it. He determined it was obscene, which was my whole point. Why is this stupid, dumb cop determining it's obscene, right? And then they came and raided me later on that afternoon by the time I'd sold all 100 copies, though. And there was lineups around the corner. There were hundreds and hundreds of people coming to buy that CD. It was made immensely much more popular in London, Ontario, because it was banned than it ever would have been. Yeah, and that's where the Me So Horny line comes from. Me Love You Long Time. That was in their most popular song on that album, right? And it's funny. That one is funny in retrospect. There's far worse out there in every form now, but imagine. So, yeah, those are the things I built my career on.
At that now, it makes it seem, in some ways it seemed like we were losing a lot of freedoms right now. But I mean, to think back to that you could get get raided for an album for a musical album. I mean, in some ways we've come a long way. You should hear the shit my kids.
And look at pot in Canada. I mean, pot in Canada and the States. I mean, it must have taken 20 years after those signatures were signed and stuff in the early 2000s. Now look at how far it's come for legalization.
However, though, the problem is it's not because of benevolent government. The government of Canada passed the worst cannabis act that you could imagine. It was so corrupt. It handed the entire industry to cops, Liberal Party insiders, bagmen, corporate heists, the worst people. And so yet the government gave itself 4 levels of taxation. They hired tens of thousands of new bureaucrats in governments at the provincial and federal level. They are the monopoly wholesale distributors making way too much money in 9 out of 10 provinces and the monopoly retailers in 5 provinces. So the big winner was government, government, and more government. And the big losers were everybody else. Now, there is one exception to that, and it's an important exception, is that charges, say, in 2010, let's say at the apex of the Stephen Harper period, 80,000 people were charged in the year 2010. Now, maybe only 8,000 to 12,000 were convicted. But you know what? 80,000 people had to hire a lawyer, go to court, you know, face some possible prosecution, some bullshit, might have been fired, might also. That's just in 1 year. We don't even have 500 people charged with a cannabis offense a year now. So,
yeah, it's made it a lot more chill out there in that retrospect, and it's driven the prices down a little bit.
And you can kind of smoke pot anywhere. Like, even more, it's more legal than tobacco, in truth, because you can smoke pot in places and people won't look at you disgustedly like they will with a cigarette, right? I don't know if that's fair or not, but I suppose secondhand pot smoke isn't as dangerous. But I would say, yeah, and boy, does this generation take it for granted. I people told me that would happen. Mark, in 10 years, nobody will know it was ever illegal, and they'll forget all about you. And I said, really, is that true? Wow, that's amazing. And but then I thought, well, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe the current generation shouldn't grow up with that same kind of weird fear that we grew up with, and that kind of ostracization and stuff. So, you know, just like my dad said, I hope that you never know what war is like, because he was in World War II for 5 years. And he said, it's one of the reasons we're in Canada now, right? He said, this is the least likely place I feel that you'll be drafted into a war, right? And, but, you know, I had my dad to tell me what war was like, and we had hundreds of books about how horrible and terrible it is, right? And I feel we're getting so distant from a lot of those genuine challenges we once had as a culture, and we're producing a strange culture of overindulged people, men and women.
It's like it turned a whole generation against cops too. It's, you know, it's like I could never just have a half decent relationship with cops because I was always this weird criminal.
I'm torn. You know, I wish I could be in favor of cops, but I've seen them act as the lackeys of the power structure so often. And at the same time, I've seen them show such cowardice in the interests of Canada. Like their zealousness in COVID was truly distasteful, right? That's more like a paramilitary cops of the Nazi era going around hassling people for weird made up crimes and shit like that. Those cops in Calgary that tried to get that guy off the ice rink, that's burned in my memory, right? Like you're going to arrest the guy because he's out in a park during your so-called COVID crisis, and you actually have the time to come and arrest him, right? And then I saw the same thing with enforcing the mandates, and the same thing with, you know, the way they suck up to the Palestinians and the Gazans, and rail blockades. They show real cowardice in rail blockades. Like, it's not just two-tier policing, there's multi-tier policing. How the trucker's convoy was treated versus, like, that Tamara Lynch has been, what, in court 47 days now? And she's been charged with mischief, for God's sake. Mischief. God, I faced far, far worse than that, right? And I didn't have 4 days in court, let alone that. And I've been 40 prisons and jails for my stuff, so. You know, they're just dragging her through the whole process, right? And they've got our money, so, you know, that's what they do.
Being taught a lesson. So you get extradited to the States. What was that like? Because, I mean, that's gotta be like, oh, my God, what's going to happen? Because you actually, I think you did 5 years down there, didn't you?
Yep, and 5 years waiting to go down there, too. Because, like, my lawyer, Ian Donaldson, one of the best extradition lawyers you could ever get, highly recommend the guy. He was so nice to me too. He charged me very little. Most of his clients, he said, are actually bad people, but have a lot of money, so he can make money from them. He said, but you're a good person. I rarely ever get to deal with those. He said, so I'll charge you next to nothing, which he did. Like, it was amazing. 5 years of this guy's unbelievably good. And he said, but Mark, the Americans get what they want. Always, always, always. I have never seen it not happen. He said, so you're going there. He said, but they said 6 months. They're very wrong. He said, I can delay this for a long, long time until we get a better deal. And we'll get a better deal because I'm really good at delaying. He said, so that's our strategy. Get them down from what they're seeking now, which is 28 to 40 years, which is life, basically, for you, and get it to something where we can live with. He said, and your co-accused, they want 10 years for them. He said, "That's, we're gonna have to get that down too." He said, "So we're just gonna have to hold out." And sure enough, after 5 years, they come back with a final offer. Your friends don't go to jail. They just have to plead guilty, never come to the United States again. They're gone. And you have to agree to 5 years. And then when it came back, you know, my lawyer said, "It doesn't get any better than that, Mark." He said, "You get your friends off. Nobody has to go down but you." You know, he said, "That's kind of saintly of you, really, right, to agree to it, because we could hold out for a while." But he said, "On the other hand, you know, get it over with. 5 years, you can see that down the road." So eventually, that's what happens. So 5 years in the waiting. And that's interesting, right? Because I've got to see a probation or, you know, officer every 2 weeks or something. And my phone calls are still all monitored. They were monitored like since 2003, right through to when I get extradited in 2010. God, I didn't have phone sex very often, but I remember one critical moment with my wife at the time that I did before. And then when I read records later that said that they had tapped my phone for like ever, right? I said, "Oh, that's funny." But anyway, okay, so those are the things you reflect on. Yeah, I did 5 years in six different prisons. Every kind of prison I was in the United States. I was in an immigrant prison. Hated that. Oh, boy. They don't spend money on that, I'll tell you that. That was a bare bones place. I was there for like 6-7 months. And because my blog post referred to it as the stupidest place on earth, they all got upset about it and they transferred me. And I've been in warehouses like the holdover where they're waiting to send you to a place. I've been in the hub in Oklahoma City. That's fascinating, but morbid and very dark and gloomy. I was in Yazoo, Mississippi, U.S. federal prison medium. And that was a good place to be if you had to be anywhere for 2.5-3 years. Yeah. And then I was in a, you know, a few other places I've forgotten. Oh, yeah. SeaTac, the remand center while I was in court. So six places.
Did anyone know you when you went in there? Did you have any notoriety?
Yeah, no, everybody did. I was treated great everywhere I went. I must tell you, my experience in prison would be different from anybody else. Additionally, guys like Tommy Chong and other famous people would go on TV wearing a T-shirt of mine. A guy who was really helpful was Wiz Khalifa. He wore my T-shirt, one of his videos, Know Better, where he's rolling a lot of doobies. And if you watch that video, you'll see him wearing a Free Mark jersey. But Tommy was really terrific. And I was often on TV while I was in prison. I was on shows in National Geographic, the Science Channel, documentary. And so I showed up a lot in that time period while I was in prison. So guys got to see me on TV. That will elevate your status a lot, to be on TV for something that's not heinous and like murder. You're not going to be described well. Or, you know, if somebody was on TV and it was about their sex crimes, that wouldn't be good for a prisoner. But for me,
well, at that time, weed was already big into the subculture, right? There was already a huge subculture of weed that would have, you know, because that's got to be like, what's that movie with Dave Chappelle where he like they get the weed from the thing? Half baked is coming out. You know, it's really the heyday of weed.
That movie has riotous scenes in it. It's not a perfect movie by any means, but it's a great movie for weedsters. It's up there with the. White Castle ones. And,
Happy Gilmore.
And the first Friday ones. No, not Happy Gilmore. What's the Indian and I've forgotten their names.
Kumar.
Harold.
Harold and Kumar. Both those are great. The first two Fridays are great weed movies, right? I used to catalog all the ones that were good weed movies, right? They don't make many anymore. Even Dude, Where's My Car, which never has weed in it, is an awesome weed movie because they work with the culture and not with the weed, so they can pull it off.
What about Dazed and Confused?
I didn't like that. I thought that, and that's done by a major director too. That's Richard Linklater, who did other great films. But that movie has a mean spirit to it that I didn't like. Plus, the guys who are the cool guys reminded me of too much of my high school, and I didn't like those guys. And yet, they were a dominant part of the film. So I should probably watch it again. But I thought it was too mean-spirited at the time. A pop movie should have an element of fun. That's why I don't like the one that Seth Rogen did called Pineapple Express. Because
it gets a little dark, right?
Well, it was really a cocaine movie that for some reason they decided to call a marijuana movie, right? That's how Weeds, the show on TV, got. eventually there was so much weird fucking organized crime shit that I'm thinking, you know, I've dealt with weed in some form or another all my life, and I've never had to deal never with organized crime.
Right? What about Superbad?
Superbad is a great film, but is it a stoner film?
I don't know. See, I'm like a super stoner, so they're all stoner films.
Superbad is an outstanding film. Great, great movie. But at the center of it, it's not about weed. But it is a wonderful film. Rogan has two great films. What's the other one? 40-Year-Old Virgin or Judge Apatow has two great films. But
oh, in the chats, we got, what about is the Zombieland?
Never watch any zombie stuff. No, so I have no idea.
I also try to stay away from that kind of. I'm not.
I stay away from horror genres too. And I'm raising four girls, and we're not going to have that in the house anyway. So, although one of them is kind of into horror genre, so that's what happens when you try and stop that. Yeah. So
you got stuck doing the whole 5 years. Eh? You didn't couldn't get out early or anything like that.
Two things I want to bring up about that. I applied to come home early, and the U.S. accepted, and the Canadian government refused to take me back. Harper didn't want to take me back. No, they can't legally refuse to take me back. The treaty requires them to take me back. So what they do is they leave it on the desk of the minister, and it doesn't get dealt with, right, for whatever bullshit reason they want to come up with. And the bullshit reason is they just didn't want me to have a day extra, because if I had to come back to Canada, I'd have got out a bit early. So that wasn't happening. So I did every last day you could possibly do. I did get 45 days off for good behavior, but in the U.S. federal system, there's no parole. You get like a few good days, and you could easily screw that up by getting an infraction and you lose them. So it's designed for good behavior, because the real lure to an American prisoner is that he gets out on halfway house 6 months earlier than normal. That sort of stuff's not available to foreign aliens, to illegal aliens, right? And so I had to do the whole time. And then additionally, I had to do 6 weeks in deportation, in immigration, in ICE deportation facility. So after I finished my criminal sentence on July 9th, 2014, I spent the next 6 weeks at a deportation facility in Alexandria, Louisiana. So that was the sixth place. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, Kansas fucking county jail. Oh, the worst place. And to think people were there for like years and years. Well, that was an awful place.
Got big in the chat says he still remembers buying seeds from your store when you were the only person selling them. They bought a big mushroom too and ate it on a mountain.
Yeah, there was a lot of mountains nearby. That's between 1995 and 2005. So the peak period for the best selection of seeds would have been, I think, 2000 to 2002. Oh, man. There was some people who have never been replicated. I would love to have found out what happened to them. The problem today is that everything has become homogenous. There isn't the distinction that there once was 20 and 30 years ago when people bought specific breeds from a place to Amsterdam or, you know, to here, to me, and then we would reproduce them and then sell them. Here's something I discovered from, I used to have a Toker's Bowl from 2002 to 2005. We'd have 25 different kinds of weed, and we'd invite up to 100 people to come and have 3 days of nonstop parties and entertainment and cool stuff for $750. I think in the 2005, it got up to $900, right? But you got all your weed covered, food, meal. You just had to get your hotel locally, and we even had a way to get you a discount on one of those. And then, so I gave this guy, I thought, you know what the thing is? Too many cups that judge cannabis is determinant not upon the genetics, but upon the ability of the grower. So what I should do is get 25 different kinds of genetics and give it to the same grower and have him grow them out. And then objectively, we can see which one is preferable because there will be no variation in the technique, right, which is often a factor. So in 2002, it was fucking amazing. I picked a great grower to do this, Pat Walsh in Greenwood, BC, and which nobody can find him now, so I don't know what happened to him, but he was amazing. And they were beautiful, smelled incredible. I've never had such beautiful fragrances, right? And 2003 and 2004 was pretty much the same. But by 2005, the smells had become more homogenous. The high had become more homogenous, and even the look of each variation became more similar, because eventually they're growing under the same conditions, so they're going to look and respond the same way. All the reason that those strains I originally gave him were unique is because they had come from like Malawi or Colombia or Mexico or Pakistan or Afghanistan, right? They had come from places, Australia, all over the world. So they retained the essence of what the soil there was like, what the air was like, what the nutrients were like, what the winds were like, what the circumstances of the entire environment was like. Just like we are. When we go somewhere, we reek of where we're from. Right, whether it's skin color, accent, voice, language, smells, all sorts of stuff gives you away. Well, if we all were in the same melting pot, we're going to start getting homogenous, one would presume, all things being equal. And so that's what happened. And so I realized that now, years and years of all these seed banks showering people with whatever bullshit they've got, or even if they're good, they've been bred. We have so many legal places in the world now that people are growing like crazy, and that they've all become the same. So this is one of the reasons there's no fun in cannabis anymore, is because essentially the strains have become boring. The culture has become boring. And I think we thrived in an illegal environment as a culture much more than we are thriving as a legal. Wow. Oh, yeah.
But it hasn't the potency gone? I mean, this is more in Darren's wheelhouse, so I haven't touched the stuff in like 16 years. But
radically less. Everything has gotten worse. Hash, locally made hash is worse. Cannabis is hash. Well, there's also a tobacco nicotine viroid that's affected a lot of plants, I think. But generally, just a lot of stuff sucks. And anything that's really, really great is rare and expensive. Like, I know a few things that are legal, right? And they're awesome. But you can get like 3 joints for $55, right? Like, I mean, I make $19 an hour at a warehouse, okay? I have to compete with Indian National staking my job in depressing wages. I don't have $45, $50, fucking $60 for 3 joints. No normal person does. You know, rich people do. Like Snoop, I guess, and everybody else who's got lots of money. But that's not where I'm at. I'm buying ounces for $50, $75, $100, right? I'm fucking 3 joints of half a gram each for, anyway, it's absurd. And besides, you know, I choke on the idea.
In high school, that was my high school prices. Where I went to high school, I was paying $10 a joint, or you could get 3 for 20.
Listen, I won't cheat you. Cannabis prices have come down. Like when I can buy an ounce for $75, that same ounce would have been better, but it, you know, 30 years ago, it would have been $200, right? So cannabis has come way down in price, but it's come way down in quality too. The mass production aspect of it has hurt it.
Wow, I didn't realize that. I thought it was the opposite.
No, I dare someone to get me high. It's not going to happen. No, really. Most stuff is just not good enough. It's just not.
I mean, well, Darren has the tolerance probably similar, probably next to you. I mean, I would say,
but I shouldn't have a big tolerance, right? Because I haven't been smoking good weed, right? Like I have not smoked anything I consider stellar that breaks the paradigm since I had my own weed store and had 35 different kinds on sale. And I paid the most for those. I paid $3,000 an ounce. I was paying way more than anybody else, $3,000 a pound, and way more than anybody else because I wanted the best, and I wanted to be able to tell people my shop, the busiest shop that ever was, 2,000 people a day, 2 shifts of 14 people for 28 full-time employees, right? We were doing like pounds and pounds a day, all in jars. You could smell it, look at it, sniff it, right? It was all $6 to $12 a gram. Right. But fuck, there was so much incredible stuff in there. I just loved being able to buy from. And because I was paying the most, people with the best came to me. Right. They said, I hear you're paying, you know, he said, well, I've got stuff that will rock your world. And they did. And so our customers loved that. And word got out. We had lineups. Sometimes it took, well, we did 2000 people a day. So there was a lineup all day. It's when we went outside that we were a bit ostentatious. But yeah, we would still clear a lineup in the store in about 10, 15 minutes because we had like 14 stations of people, you know.
So this is in Vancouver then? Or
No, this is Toronto. This is in the gay district.
Oh, Toronto. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
So would Toronto, you have been, if you wouldn't have been selling those seeds to the States, would you just probably been just able to keep going, do you think?
Oh, for sure. No one's ever been charged for selling seeds in the U.S. but me, ever. American, a warrant was out for Neville Schumacher for a couple of decades. He was a guy who ran the, is it this Super Sensi Seed Club? That's it. In 1988 and until about 1992 when he sold it to Ben Dronkers of the Sensi Seed Bank. I think that's about right. Maybe a little earlier. But he started sending seeds and they put a warrant out for him. And he consequently never really traveled because he was afraid of being picked up, which eventually would have happened to me too. But otherwise no one's ever been to prison for seeds other than me. And a Canadian at that, but just so you know, that to some degree is a badge of honor.
Total badge of honor. I mean, this is fantastic. And
what's the time frame for that?
I still think my greatest triumph, if I had to rate things I got done, I would say paying for the Colorado 2000 medical initiative, getting the signatures and getting it passed. I couldn't believe that. That was rocking.
But so did that take a while to come in effect afterwards? Like it feels like
Colorado came into effect immediately, but wow. the big one was 2008. Now in 2008, that was a real organized project of the Marijuana Policy Project and a number of others. And there was a great guy in charge of that, Mason Tvert. I don't know what's become of him. I think he still is Marijuana Policy Project, but they're more low key now, or they've accomplished so much that people forget about them. That I think getting 3 million seeds out, and of course that was brought up when I was being sentenced too, which was very nerve wracking, because although we'd had an agreed terminology, hearing my lawyer. Like the district attorney got up and said, "Your Honor, I bring before you Mark Emery, charged with trafficking in cannabis seeds. Your Honor, we believe Mr. Emery is responsible for producing more marijuana than any other individual or organization brought before the criminal justice system of the United States in our lifetime. He has produced, by selling 3 million seeds, possibly several tons of marijuana that will go on for decades to come." And I'm thinking, fucking right, this is incredible. It's my life's dream to have a U.S. district attorney say that, but not necessarily if I'm in his courtroom, because what he described was the extreme end of the potentiality of the act, which merits the extreme potentiality of the sentence, which is life. So I'm thinking, oh fuck, I'm so proud of that, but that is so deadly. So my lawyer gets up and says, "Your Honor, realistically, it wouldn't have been 3 million. It would be somewhere like more like 750,000 to a million seeds if we presume that half were males and some didn't germinate." And I'm thinking, that still sounds really bad. It's not 3 million, Your Honor. It's a million, right? Now, of course, for an American, it's the death penalty if you are responsible for producing 60,000 plants, 6 tons. Right. And they consider seeds the same as plants. Right. So if I was an American, they could possibly threaten me with the death penalty because you're a drug kingpin of the maximum possible. Like no one else has ever produced more weed than you. Right. But because I was Canadian, they had to actually agree not to give me the death penalty in order for them to extradite me. So that's every Canadian can get that. If you're going to be extradited in the United States, they will not let you go if you're going to get the death penalty or if that's not taken off the table. Right. And you don't go, but otherwise I'll give you.
So then what year do
the
you
second one was, oh, my second
go ahead? No, you go ahead. Go
so
ahead.
The guy who prosecuted me, the district attorney, John McKay. So oddly enough, if you watch that movie, Prince of Pot, it's done by a guy named Nick Wilson. He went to interview John McKay and he asked him a strange question, which John McKay agrees to answer. And Nick Wilson says, "Do you feel bad about what you did sentencing, prosecuting Mark Emery and putting a guy like this in jail?" The director thinking I'm a good guy. And he says, no, he's criminal and he did blah, blah, blah. And he goes on and he justifies his prosecution of me before the U.S. courts. But then 6 months later, he resigns. And then, incredibly, A year later, he writes the legalization initiative in Washington State in 2012 that passes. For some reason, he quit, joined some legalization group. They nominated him to write up a ballot initiative, which he did, that they got on a ballot that passed, that he was fully responsible for. So I'm thinking, so weirdly enough, I'm spending 5 years in a federal prison while the guy who prosecuted me, John McKay, just wrote the legalization in Washington, D.C., where I was convicted, right?
I wonder if it was just like you were on his conscience. He just couldn't live
with it. I wonder about that, but that phrase haunts me from that movie. He says, do you feel bad about what you've done? Like, no one ever asked district attorneys that. And he hesitates, right? Because he's probably stunned by the question. But the fact is, 6 months later, he quit. Just quit. And then wrote that thing, joined some legalization group. And so I thought that was a fascinating, quiet triumph. That's not something I can boast. But it does show you that, you know, over time, you can.
Well, I mean, I think you can boast that you played a role because, I mean, you've got all these initiatives sort of starting in the early 2000s and nothing happens fast. And then, you know, all of a sudden in 2012, states start falling like dominoes, you know, and two of the states that you do initiatives in are the first two. Washington and Colorado are the first two.
Yeah, I didn't have much to do with financing either of those. I didn't have anything to do with financing those, of course, at that time. But the fact that two of them did that year was really good, because you might say, oh, that's a one-off because there are Fruit Loops up in Seattle and shit, and maybe even in Colorado. But two on the same year, and of course, many, many more since, right? Like, I mean, I think almost every state has some medical access except about four, Idaho being one of them, right? But and the federal government's going to come around. It's all opportunism, though. The federal government's only going to remove it from the schedule when somebody gets paid off or something, right?
Well, you don't think Trump will do it? I mean, Trump's talking about it.
But here's the thing about Trump talking about things. He could have done it the first time. Like, how come we didn't get the JFK stuff out from, you know, the first time? How come we didn't get all the inside classified files the first time? Like, he should have declassified a ton of stuff. How come that wall wasn't finished? Now, I have a few answers for those. First of all, Congress was trying to obstruct him. The bureaucracy is trying to obstruct him. Like, they won't even do what he says sometimes. When he says withdraw from Syria, they don't even do it, right? Like, I'm thinking, hold on, he's the commander in chief. If you refuse to do what he says, you're all committing treason. That's high treason, right? So I get that Trump had obstructions, and if I were him, I would clear those out so he can get something done in 4 years. 4 years isn't a long time. And the American system is bureaucratic, like the Canadian system. So very little changes very radically in Canada. It's a slow rot, a slow manipulation, a slow control that we have in both those countries, Canada and the U.S., right? This is why it's hard to undo, because we keep hiring all these bureaucrats and government people who have their own interests at stake, not Canadian interests, right? So that's going to be the problem for John Ristad and the Conservatives here after the election on October 19th, as I'm sure Daniel Smith has found that too in Alberta.
Oh, yeah.
And Poilievre will find it too. They fucking hired a ton of more people in the federal government, right?
100,000 in Canada. I mean, federally. I mean, it's unbelievable.
No, and that's not sustainable. To pay for 100,000 bureaucrats, you probably need at least 1 million workers paying taxes. And that maybe 2-3 million. Because they're paid well. We're paid, you know, junk out here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
None of us kept up with the fucking inflation. Trudeau wouldn't have a clue about how food has gone up.
No, so much. Double. But it's double.
I do the shopping. I see it. And man, it's some scary shit. So many products have been diluted too. Like fucking no-name hot chocolate went from 2 tablespoons to 3 tablespoons overnight.
Shrinkflation, yeah.
Right. I've got cereals like that. I've got Tide went down 8.8% 3 months ago, and so on, right? And
that's I heard John Rustad on a long-form interview. It is interesting how people on this side of the political thing can do long-form interviews. You know, you never really see the left do long form interviews, but I mean, and I really liked your political attitude. I heard you on a show like Conservative Canadian, I think from 2021, talking about your, you know, your PPC run there.
Right.
And stuff.
Oh, love that.
But Rustad seems to be pretty common sense and doing sort of doing it for the right reasons. And
well, here's the great thing about John Rustad. I like him because he should never be in the position he's in.
Yeah.
He is like James Stewart in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And I really like that. So we're down to 20% power on my thing. Probably could charge up, but that should be okay for another 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So he got kicked out because he expressed some climate skepticism, got kicked out of BC United, right? And then next thing you know, he's got a few guys from BC United and he's wiped them out. And now he's...
Well, that was weird. Wow. Hey, I don't know if he leaned on the... He might have leaned down on the hang-up button there. But yeah, he was just talking about Rustad getting, like, starting up the political party. I didn't realize the whole story. Have you ever heard that, Darren?
I haven't heard the whole story. Yeah, no, I don't know much
fascinating.
About the BC political scene. I'm assuming his phone died and he's going to be a minute to come back. So, if it's an Apple phone, it always takes a couple minutes to turn back.
No, he said he had 20%. So he might be, he might've just leaned on the button and hit the button. But
anyway, I'm sure he'll be back. So, did you listen to the Jordan Peterson interview then? Is that what you're talking about? There he is there.
I got
Oops.
There we go. We're back. Yep. Yeah, sure I did listen to the Jordan Peterson. Yeah, you were talking about Rustad's coming back.
So anyway, so he goes over and joins some moribund party that hasn't done fuck all in ever. And it's just basically keeping that on the ballot warm. And there's nobody who's an MLA from that party. This is so funny. And he goes over there and he says, okay, I'll join your party. And because they have no one else, they say, okay, you're the leader of the party. He goes, okay, fine. It's a good name. I like that. And then the other guy across the way, who's his friend, says, hey, I'll join your party. Two people is all you need for official party status in British Columbia, because they did that for the Greens, right? It used to be 4 or even 8. But because the Greens, part of their bargaining with the NDP was you've got to give us party status at 2, they've lowered the threshold. So suddenly the BC Conservative Party is a going thing, right? With 2 guys. And he immediately starts polling 15-16% just because he's climate skeptical. And then he becomes skeptical about Soji and all the other shibboleths of BC politics. Like he says, we need more mining. We need more logging. We need more. Absolutely, we fucking do. Right? We need more of all that stuff that the BCNDP is against, right? And also, there's just so many bullshit things going on. The carbon tax is high here. My gas is higher here than anywhere else in Canada, right? They charge you 25 cents for a paper bag you used to get for free because they're made to charge 25, you know, and $2 for a dumbass cloth bag it costs 5 cents to make in Bangladesh, right? Just to punish us, right? That's the BCNDP thinks that you can change human behavior by punishment. And you probably can. But you'll have a slightly psychotic or neurotic population how you want to govern.
Which seems to be happening.
Well, there's no shortage of broken people out there, let me tell you. Whoa, broken people. Like the number of people heavily medicated on psychotropics, women especially, but people generally, young people on Ritalin, like fucking ADHD, come on, you know, wow. All this stuff, right? Babysitters. Nobody wants to deal with any problems, so we give them babysitters. That's what all these drugs are.
So have you ever thought about going back into politics then? Or how did that PPC run go? Do you want to talk about that at all? Or like,
I've never been given the finger so many times in my life as I would every day. See this thing. I kind of thought I would get 5% of the vote, and I got exactly 5% of the vote. So nothing changed, right? When I went in, I feel it, right? From the amount of money we got, from the amount of signs I put out, I knew it was going to be 5%, right? And that was fine. That's a good starting base, and hopefully the next person can build on it. Though that'll be tough because PLR has come to ascend in a way that O'Toole and Scheer could never do, right? They were always going to be fucking liberal light, right? Whereas Poilievre talks a good game. Sounds like he might actually do something, even if he completely lacks all policy statements to that effect.
we're skeptical. We're skeptical either, no matter what. I mean, you know.
Well, Maxime sticks by his stuff, man.
Maybe.
He hasn't changed his tune. He has no reason to. He could be much more popular by being less like be more flexible, less principled.
Well, that's kind of what you were saying in your politics. When I heard you talk about it, you were like, forget what the populace wants. If I'm going to change my principles, you got to, it's got to be principles first, right? Like you were pushing for your things, no matter what the people wanted.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not like they don't know what I stand for after, like, I'm a known quantity in Ontario, Canada, BC for like 40 years. So, but that said, I'd love to run for the PPC, but another candidate has this nomination out here. Now, up till yesterday, I thought the next election would be a year away, but it might be much, much sooner. Because when I looked at the latest poll, the NDP was going to go up due to this kind of awful Liberal collapse. And I think they just looked at the numbers and said, we need some good excuse for an election, but we should go to the polls. And the NDP said, yeah, but we're, you know, probably going to get trounced. Yes, but not relative to the Liberals. In a lot of formerly Liberal ridings, we could do all right, because those are ridings in urban centers that the Conservatives just won't do well in, even if they defeat the Liberals everywhere else. So suddenly I'm thinking there will be an election, because I was just advising the candidate out here that I would cease all meet and greets until after October 19th. I said, because right now everybody's focused on the provincial election, getting rid of the NDP. That wave will help you after October 19th. But a federal candidate going doing meet and greets right now is confusing, right? Because people are going to say, are you on the ballot? You know, so you don't want that. You want to raise money from now to October 19th, I told him, and then start doing meet and greets on October 20th, expecting a late fall or winter election or even spring election. But certainly one sooner than next fall, right? The NDP are going to cash in while the getting's good, and the Conservatives can't wait.
Rumor is March, because Jughead gets his pension in February.
Oh, he's got it by now, surely.
Now, February 1st of 2025 is when he becomes pension eligible.
When did he first serve as MP?
I don't know, but I keep looking it up, because I've been thinking that his pension date was going to be the election for a while.
No. Because you only have to serve 6 years.
Yeah, that'll be his. So right now he's in his sixth year. His sixth year ends in February.
Right. So there you go. March it is.
March. Perfect. March will be the day.
Perfect.
So do you think, is it looking like, well, actually, before we transition into that, what date did you get? Are you allowed in the States if you went to prison there?
No, I'm barred for life. I'm barred in lots of countries. Russia banned me a year or two ago. And it's official, too. They actually released a diplomatic memo from their embassy in Ottawa saying these people are banned from Russia and Russian airspace. Right. And I'm on that list with my ex-wife, Jody. And then I'm banned in Australia, because if you do more than a year, you can't get admittance. And half the time I've been banned in Canada for a while there, not being vaccinated, couldn't get in planes and trains. So, you know, periodically I get banned in Canada, and I'm certainly banned in the US, and I'm banned in China.
So you go to jail there, and then they're like, all right, get out and don't ever.
There's other places too. I'm banned in Panama, because they told me when they refused me to transit to Colombia through Panama, and they held me and sent me back to Mexico, they said anybody who's banned in the U.S. or Canada is banned here now. We are sharing the same information system. So that's going to be happening more and more around the world. So, you know, I'm glad I got all my traveling done when I could.
Did they send you a letter from Russia? I might frame that.
No, but there was a press release. It was covered. So if you look, put a Mark Emery banned in Russia. I also on my Twitter reproduced the official Russian embassy release. Right. So you can. So I'm number 600 and some odd on that list. So if you look, Canadians banned in Russia, you'll get that list.
I wonder if I could make that list.
Well, the fact is, in the Ukraine-Russian war, I support the Russian position. It's very strange, really. But, you know, whatever. Putin's, you know, he'll do what he does. But to me, the Ukrainian position is untenable. Those have always been Russian territories, Russian spaces. They were just given to Ukraine in 1955 by Khrushchev to solidify the USSR, figuring they'd always be like brothers, since Ukraine has been kind of inherently Russian forever, right? And it was part of the Russian Empire, the Russian. So, you know, they all speak the same language. They have the same culture, essentially. It doesn't make any sense for them to be at war. And Russia's claims are good. I mean, I don't believe they want to expand further. And it was stupid concoctions by the West that got us all into this mess, right? Trying to get them in NATO, stupid idea, right? Overthrowing their government, 2014. I mean, there's a few times CIA overthrows have been good. 1953 was good, putting the Shah in place in Iran. That was a good move, right? Putting Pinochet in Chile, excellent move. You know, both
good move for who in Iran?
Yeah, well, no, it was an excellent idea in Iran. That country prospered for 26 years until Ayatollah Khomeini. But yeah, probably I'm going to run out of power. But listen, this has been great. I've enjoyed this conversation. I normally am impossible to get for podcasts because even though I always have fun, like you have to be there for them.
And no, this was great. This was fun. Yeah, we appreciate it. It's great to talk to you because we're both.
Have any questions that I never got, that I never heard or got around you? That was the point of your show. Like I kind of
So we just
had something you wanted to ask.
No, it's all. It's just perfect. It's good. Yeah.
No, it was perfect.
Yeah, because I got a million stories. Like we should do a whole story of all the famous people I met, what happened, and stuff. Like Steve Tyler, really nice guy, Aerosmith, so nice to me. But Joe Perry, he scowled at me in a way I've never been scowled at before. like hi Joe Perry, you know, and then wow, you know, but it was like a fierce thing. So, and then people whispered to me, he does that to everybody. Don't take it personally. And I'm thinking, okay. Well, I guess that's why he's not the band leader. Right. So
anyway. We just want to get your opinion on all the Canadian stuff that's going on, including drugs and politics and all that. I mean, it's great. Hey, Darren, what do you think?
Yeah, no, this is perfect. This has been great. I'd love to do it. I mean, it's funny because I grew up in London, Ontario, too, for the first little while of my life.
Oh, really? What street? Where? What?
You know, to go back and say which street, I'd have to talk to my mom. I'm sure she's listening, so she'll let me know. But wow. I was only there until grade two.
Every street in London, Ontario. Every street. So I know every street there is. And now, there's probably been some new ones in the last 20 years. I wouldn't know those. But I delivered pamphlets for my bookshop, City Lights Bookshop. And I would deliver myself 30,000 every season, right, by hand. So I got to visit every single house in London. A lot of beautiful homes, I used to say. And I used to go in so many of them to buy their old books and stuff.
This would have been like late 80s, probably. Late 80s.
Okay, I didn't leave until 92, so I'm still there then. In fact, that's when I'm going to jail. You've got to remember that. That's when I did Two Live Crew. That's when I did the drug literature. All my really cool stuff happened from 86 to 92. I've been coasting on my laurels since then. Not really, but you know.
No, this has been great. Let's keep in touch and let's do this again.
Yeah, sure. Whenever you want, guys.
Thanks, buddy.
Okay.
Take care. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah. And that was a chat with Mark Amory. What'd you think?
Oh, classic. Instant classic.
Instant classic. The people, hard to believe.
Yeah, the people in the chats were like, oh, this is going to be a classic right away.
It's always nice to, like you said in the beginning, chat with one of these guys that you've known about forever, and then you chat with them and find out that you guys got a bunch in common. You know, you view the world in the same way.
Yeah.
Like, maybe we're not as unique as we think.
Exactly. And that's happened with quite a few guests because we don't know, you know, I don't necessarily know the depth of every guest we have on. Sometimes I listen to a podcast or two or read a book or I do the research, but sometimes we just find out like, oh my God, we're not alone here. Like there's a bunch of people have found what we found when they're going down this sort of path towards trying to find out what's going on.
That's right. And it's a hell of a second half. It's another doozy with some more great stories. I mean, this is a good storytelling app where the stories are just the stories alone are worth the price of
admission. Oh yeah. We talk about helping addicts in BC with Ibogaine. So we get into that whole problem, like the drug situation right now. The lack of fatherly influences, the Prince George rehab experiment, more on immigration and Mark Miller opening Canada up, the Indian influence on BC politics and immigration and the Canadian culture wars. Did we talk about in the outro about my mom, like the other commonalities were like his mom came over, like I think very similar years to when my mom came over or his parents maybe.
I don't know that we did get into it, but
it's very similar too. In the early 50s, I guess that was what was, you know, that's when that sort of immigration wave from the UK came over. So the folks were both part of that.
There you have it, guys. Sign up for Plus today. It's less than the price of a cup of coffee these days. $6 a month gets you everything. Try it for a week. Try it for a month. You could download everything in like a couple of days, cancel it if you hate it. Just do it. Give us $6. I mean, even the $6 is better than nothing. So try it out. GrimericaOutlaw.ca. Sign up today. Of course, Grimerica.ca for our other podcasts. Contact At The Cabin for the trips. And AdultBrain.ca for the audiobooks. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening. And we will see you next week.
So many cigarettes, so perfume.